Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's talk about this case. This is one that really blew my mind. Basically, because first of all, it involves a young person. And I think that's always really challenging because we look at young people, particularly teenagers, and we see them as evolving human beings. They're not fixed. We all know who we were when we were 14. I had very bad perms, for example. Now, I don't have bad perms. I'm not saying my hair's great, but it doesn't look like I'm 48 years old, which it did when I was 14. You grow, you change, etc. But to some degree, when somebody commits a crime at this age, it's a hard one to manage because you have to ask yourself the question, is it that they are developing and changing and evolving and then will grow into a human being who recognises the errors of their ways? Or actually, is this the very burgeoning behaviour that is so problematic for society that these individuals will never be safe to walk our streets? And I guess that's a question I'm going to ponder throughout this. Because when we talk about nature nurture, when you look at Aaron Schmidt, his early years, they literally exemplify the absolutely crushing impact of adverse childhood experiences. So he was actually born in 1996, and he was born into a completely dysfunctional family, really, really deeply troubled family situation. First of all, his mother, she actually struggled with drug addiction. Aaron's biological father was much older than his mother, and he'd actually fathered several children with Aaron's mother when she was still a minor. So in essence, Aaron was basically the product of a non-consensual relationship, because when you are a minor, you cannot consent to these sexual relationships. And obviously that's an origin that, when you just consider those factors, places him in immediate jeopardy. And with respect, when you look at research, children born into these situations, they just have amazingly huge challenges right from the start, because often what you will find is poverty exists in cohesion with the actual abuse that I'm talking about. And that's the first layer of trauma. So they often don't have basic necessities. They don't have decent clothing, reliable meals. They've got unstable housing. This all compounds the issue. That means that they'll be moving from place to place with absolutely no sense of security. And bear in mind, for Aaron, the fact that his mother had this drug use dependency, that means that he and his siblings were in an environment that was wholly unfit for their development. And that means that when you think about him going into education, understandably, he's going to struggle. And his academic journey was basically marked by upheaval. And as a professional working in this field, I cannot stress how chaotic home environments mean that a child is going to suffer most likely in school performance, in their ability to contain their emotions. So there'll often be people who have outbursts at school. They'll struggle to actually relate to their peers because they're having a completely different experience at home. And indeed, when Aaron's teachers talked about him, they said he was really withdrawn, he was really moody, he would just fly into these fits of unpredictable rage that were very challenging to manage. So what we have here is the layers of trauma, parental neglect, abuse, constant upheaval, which means that the stability and concentration at school that he would need is just going to be absolutely 100% out of reach. And just to go into a little bit of detail, when it comes down to Aaron Schmidt's life, as I said, his father was a child abuser, and it was actually his mother's, his biological mother's stepfather. So while she's underage, she's basically been raped by this monster. And like I said, they had several children. They had three children together. The oldest was born when she was literally 13 years of age, which is just despicable to even imagine that a child is placed in that situation. It's really unsurprising as well that she ends up being a drug dependent, let's be clear. I mean, dealing with that kind of trauma, you're going to want to self-medicate something to escape the agony. So Aaron has two siblings. He is the youngest of the three children. Now, bear in mind, when he is actually born, his father, his biological parents, in prison, not for the rape of his own mother, but for the rape of another woman, which is just beyond heinous to even begin to comprehend. And also what I found is that it was a very abusive environment. So there's some evidence that there was physical, emotional, and even sexual abuse happening to the children. Now, the children end up going to stay with their half-sister. So that's the father's daughter. And bear in mind, the father is considerably older than the stepdaughter that he was raping and having children with. She's actually about 40 years older. And that means that she is, to some degree, a stable adult. And they actually stayed with her for 3 weeks. This is whilst the mother is trying to find somewhere appropriate to live. Now, whilst they are actually staying in this home environment, Schmidt's older sister basically tells the half-sister what her mother's been doing to them. So she talks about all this abuse, she discloses the horror they've been going through. The half-sister did exactly the right thing. Firstly, she takes it seriously. Secondly, she gets in contact with social services. And this means that when Schmidt is 5 years of age, he gets removed from the care of his mother. Obviously, his siblings also get removed from the care of the mother, and he ends up getting placed with his half-sister. But it was acknowledged that when he moved there, he wasn't necessarily very accepted, because basically the whole family are reminded of the fact that he is essentially a product of incest. And that family secret is something that's really toxic and really challenging for everybody to acknowledge. And the consequences of that is he isn't treated very well. It's an abusive home as well, where he's moved to. So it isn't a pleasant environment. So even though he's gone from the frying pan, it doesn't mean that there isn't still a fire burning in this particular household. Now, Schmidt had actually been diagnosed with ADHD. I would also...
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Note that with a dysfunctional experience that I'm talking about right now, we would absolutely expect there to be behavioural issues. I think it's something that we're very quick to label these days, ADHD. Obviously, some people will feel very happy with that diagnosis and label, whether it's their child or themselves who are given it. But I think we have to have some realism as well about growing up in a completely unstable, dysfunctional environment where you're not safe. Of course, your behaviour is going to be off the wall. It's going to be highly unlikely you're going to behave typically because you've been brought up in a totally atypical environment. So whether that ADHD diagnosis is an appropriate one or just reactionary because his behaviour seems out there, when actually we would expect it to be out there, I don't know. But it's one of those things that concerns me because often it means that we're failing to see the symptomatic behaviours of a child based on their experience within their home, for example, because children will create symptoms to manage and manifest change to some degree in their home environment when it's really horrible. And just to note that as a side note. Now, he'd also committed a previous crime. So he'd actually received a juvenile sentence, and that had taken place over 18 months, and it was for child molestation. So that's a really serious offence. So clearly he's got some big issues. But again, we've got an environment that modelled him in this way to some degree. I'm not saying, by the way, that if you are abused, you are going to go on to abuse. Quite the contrary is true statistically. But if you are abused, you have a higher propensity to abuse than those who are not abused, i.e. peers who don't go through those experiences are less likely to abuse. But like I said, it's a tiny minority of individuals who have gone through some kind of abuse who then actually play that out in their own lives. But he is doing. Now, by January 2011, he had actually just completed that sentence. But wow, just giving you that background, you can see how challenging his world had been and how he's internalized some of those challenges and started to exhibit really inappropriate behavior. So we've got this life filled with absolute rejection, mass abuse, and bear in mind, the average child looks for safe spaces, but for Aaron, there had been absolutely none. until the day he stumbles upon what can only be described as a beacon of hope, which is in the form of the Callahan family. This is the spring of 2010. This is when Aaron, who is 13 at this point in time, crosses paths with the Callahan family. So by this time, Paul and Betty Jo Callahan and their five children, they had basically just moved into a quiet, wooded area of Columbia County. And apparently when he first noted them, he saw that they had these moving bags just stacked along their driveway, and he was lonely. He kind of wanders around and wanders over. And one of the things about the connection he's going to make with the Callahans is they are literally the opposite of every single thing that Aaron has ever known. This family is loving, stable. Also, when they meet him, they don't judge him for a second because he's ragged in his appearance or his personality is a little bit withdrawn. That just doesn't put them off whatsoever. In fact, Betty Jo and Paul had six children of their own. They're well-versed in children's differences and idiosyncrasies. They had three boys, they had three girls. They lived on Miles Road near County Line Road in Harlem, Columbia County, Georgia. This is where they'd moved with the family. And essentially, the reason that they'd moved is the father in this family was in the military. And we all know that when you are in the military, often you are beholden to being moved around because you are given new posts. The mother in this case, Betty Jo, she worked in a hospital, so very caring, vocational, compassionate human being. Certainly she picked the right career because that absolutely describes her. Also, they had a daughter who is obviously the victim in this case, Alana. She's an eighth grader. She attended Harlem Middle School and she was breathtaking in so many ways. She was an A-grade student. She actually had dreams of becoming a lawyer. She wanted to attend Harvard or Yale. So she was aspirational and everybody adored that girl. Betty Jo, the mother in this case, she was literally the kind of person that you'd want as a neighbour. She welcomed everyone, especially children, into her home. You know, if you wanted a snack, if you wanted conversation, she'd get the kettle on, she'd give you some biscuits. That's the kind of human being that she is. And that's going to be so appealing to someone like Aaron Schmidt. Bear in mind, he's never had that. He doesn't know what that's like. He doesn't know what it's like to be welcomed into a home, fed, nourished, nurtured. That is totally foreign to him. And just imagine how addictive that feels. And it doesn't take long after Aaron sees them moving in that day to actually find a reason to be at their house every single day. And they really tried to help him in so many ways. So whether it was just doing yard work with dad in the family or just hanging out with the Callahan kids in the afternoons, basically he was included massively by Paul Callahan, the dad, the patriarch. He actually got him involved as well in weekend chores and activities, and where Betty Jo was concerned, just giving him that sense of belongingness and nurture. Just imagine that for a minute. For this boy who used to be ignored or, shall we say, tolerated at that point just by the people he was living with, he must have felt like he'd landed on a completely foreign planet, one where warmth and acceptance were literally overflowing. And as I said, one of the children is Alana. She's 13 and she really stands out to Aaron. Like I said, this girl is outgoing. She's bright. She's really active in a community, in a church, Baptist youth groups. And people said that she was a child that just radiated kindness. She exuded a sense of optimism. So when Aaron sees Alana, meets Alana, starts connecting with her, he just feels that she's somebody he wants to be around. And I suppose what we would describe it as is there's almost like this puppy love begins. And they do actually end up dating. They dated for all of 3 days. And then the family's youth pastor basically advises Alana that she's too young to have a boyfriend. And she obviously takes this very seriously. And the relationship comes to an end. Now, if you think about a typical teenager, I'm sure we've all been there. I've certainly been there. This kind of short-lived relationship, it's just a small blip. It's upsetting. You know, it's something that you might laugh about down the line years later, but for Aaron, the compounding of his rejection that's occurred, it feels like it's the final straw, and it just provokes this really challenging feeling of rage within him, and he doesn't know what to do with it. Because bear in mind, this is a guy with massively insecure attachment. when you have insecure attachment, the desperate need that you have means that you want relationships that are going to make you feel secure. But the problem is often you have this cycle of consequence where because you're so needy, because you're so desperate, it puts people off. And a lot of people will acknowledge that that may have happened in their own lives. So when we look at different types of attachment style, we're talking about disorganized attachment, secure attachment, anxious attachment, avoidant attachment. There are more nuances to all of those things. But certainly, if you're an individual that's been abandoned, there's going to be a real anxiety to the way that you deal with relationships. There's also going to be lots of issues around in your mindset because you're trying to fix what is broken by somebody else that cannot be fixed by anybody but yourself. So it can mean that that person becomes really hyper fixated on the relationships that they're in, and particularly if that relationship has offered them a sense of acceptance they've never had. So whilst Alana and Ari Schmidt's 3-day romance seems trivial to the outsider, realistically to Aaron it was probably the single best thing that he'd ever had in his life, and it just felt like it was snatched away overnight. This leads to him just clinging even more desperately to the Callahans. He's desperate to be around them all the time. He even goes so far as to start calling himself Aaron Callahan on social media. Now, of course, this is a symbolic act because it reveals that he's just got this desperate longing for a family and to be part of their family. But it is also an overreach because he isn't part of their family. And that doesn't mean there isn't a space and place for him. It doesn't mean that he's not welcomed within it, but it's a boundary breach. And the Callahans notice this, and they notice that there are some other subtle signs that show some red flags. So his belongingness, his desperation for that, it basically tips into what they start to perceive as relatively intrusive behaviour. And I suppose there's one event that basically marks the beginning of the end to what actually plays out in this story. And of course, that is nothing to do with the Callahan family at all. They did everything right. But when we're dealing with this very dysfunctional, destabilised personality that certainly Aaron Schmidt has, when these events occur, for the individual from the outside looking it in, it just seems something that can be easily gotten over. For the person in it, is catastrophic beyond all belief. But because we don't live in the internal minds of individuals, we're only perceiving from the outside, we just can't comprehend that somebody can take something so badly that it starts to mean that they assert they need to do something both tragic, devastating, brutal, and horrific. And in this case, that's exactly what begins to brew. Now, Alana and Betty Jo basically come home one day and they find Schmidt alone in the house. Now, he says, as an excuse, listen, the door was unlocked, but Betty Jo's a matriarch. She knows how to run her family home. And she knows, without a shadow of a doubt, there is no way that she has not locked that door. So she thinks to herself, listen, it's very likely he's broken in. And this is a child she's dealing with. She's used to dealing with kids. She's got sticks of her own. So she essentially confronts him and she says, listen, if you want to be part of this relationship, if you want to be welcome in our home, we have to have some very clear rules. The first one is you don't enter the house unless an adult is present. Secondly, you are absolutely not allowed to visit for the next 2 weeks. This is a consequence of your behavior. You need to have some time out. And we can all appreciate it's a method that lots of people use, but we also know that as a teenager, being put on a short time out by a friend's parent is usually, for a typical adolescent, embarrassing, shall we say. It's not catastrophic, but you definitely would feel a little bit red in the cheeks and think, you know, lesson learnt. But again, we're not dealing with a typical teenager. We're dealing with Schmidt. And for him, in that moment, it was like he was losing the only safe place he'd ever known. And it's as if that boundary that's so needed, so typical, so acceptable, it's with that boundary being placed there because he, like I said, is so atypical. This darker plan begins to incubate in his mind. We get to the 31st of January 2011. This is the fateful day that this horrific crime plays out. Alana's 14 at this point. She just returns from school. Around 3:15 p.m. she gets off her bus, and actually her 18-year-old sister, Amanda, goes and picks her up from the bus stop at the end of the family's half-mile-long driveway. And the reason she does that is just basically so she can get her home safely and she doesn't have to walk all that way home. Then once she's dropped Alana off, Amanda then times it so she can go and pick up the younger brother, Chase, from the bus stop. He basically rides a later bus, so she makes sure that everyone gets home safe. Now, when Amanda and Chase arrive back from the bus stop, this is only 5 to 10 minutes later. Just let that sink in, guys. This is 5 to 10 minutes later. You can't conceive that the world can just change so dramatically in that kind of time frame, particularly when you think that you've dropped your sister off safely at home. And yet this is exactly what happens in this case. They walk into the house together and instantly they see what can only be described as a mess. And Amanda said that she immediately saw that the sliding door at the back of the house was open. Also, the computer chair was knocked over where she assumed her sister had been sitting. And even more disconcerting and disturbing, there was a pool of blood on the floor. Now, as she's trying to process this horrendous scene, obviously starting to be concerned about what could have happened to her sister, Schmidt enters the home through the front door and he's shouting. He's saying he's seen a person running through the woods and that he can't find Alana. Now, bear in mind, outside of the home in the woods, behind the house, there's obviously woodland. And so they all start to go searching, desperate, calling her name. What could have happened to Alana? What's Schmidt saying about this guy who's been seen? You know, why is there blood in the home? And it's as if Schmidt knows where she is, because he's the one who basically finds her and leads everyone to her. At this point, Amanda can't quite comprehend the sight that she is seeing, because now she's noticing that Alana's head is literally covered in blood. And she can't actually determine at that point what's happened to Alana. She has no idea whose cause this, how this has been caused. All she knows is within 5 to 10 minutes of not being at home, Alana is desperately injured or worse. Now, she's unresponsive when they're trying to bring her around. So understandably, Amanda calls 911. And then she's desperately trying to save her life by performing CPR on her. As she is performing CPR, Schmidt is just standing there and watching, and there isn't really any emotion. This is meant to be the girl that he was absolutely fixated on. This is meant to be the girl that he wanted to be around constantly. And yet now he's just kind of watching. And Amanda, understandably, as she's trying to save her sister, is realizing she's getting nowhere, and she starts to get more and more hysterical. When she's on the phone to 911 at this point, Schmidt takes over and starts to speak to the 911 operator. Now, again, what would we expect in that moment? The concentration is going to be absolutely on Alana, who is bleeding out and is seriously injured or worse. But he then starts telling the 911 operator that he'd seen a man running through the woods whilst he was on his way home. He also said that he'd actually personally gone to investigate why there was a guy down there. And this in itself kind of stands out, because we've all been 14, 15, 16. I don't know about you. If I think there is a strange guy in the locality, the last thing I'm going to go and do is try to investigate why the guy's down there, because I'm going to be thinking there's a weird guy. I'm probably just going to find an adult or speak to emergency services. So that in itself is going to stand out to the operator and indeed the authorities, because it just doesn't make sense. So he says at this point, after he's kind of had a look, he goes to the Callahan home because he wants to basically question them. Did you see this man running through the woods? And he said at this moment in time, he realizes that Alana is missing. Again, he did know the habits of this household. There is no doubt whatsoever. He was quite schooled in the itinerary, when people came, when people went. So I'm not suggesting for one minute he wouldn't have known that Alana was meant to be there. But the idea that he's seen this guy running through the woods, he then goes to the Callahans to have a conversation about this guy, then notices Alana is missing, it all feels a little bit sketchy and strange, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Now, sadly, when the emergency services arrive, they look at Alana Callahan, they see that she's unresponsive, and it doesn't take them long to pronounce that she is indeed dead, and they know exactly why. That beautiful, effervescent, kind, compassionate girl with all of that dream for her future has been literally executed. It's as simple as that. She was shot through the back of her head. That's an execution. End of. At this point, the police obviously only have to go on what Schmidt has told them. So they start searching the surrounding area for this man that Schmidt's seen. They believe at this point that potentially he's the one who's responsible for murdering this 14-year-old girl. So even though they are looking for this apparent man who's now been given this idea that he's responsible for the murder of Alana, you understand that they're also starting to think there are some inconsistencies in what Smith's saying. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And also that's upped further when nobody is actually found. So there's no evidence whatsoever of this man who's apparently been seen by Schmidt. Now, Amanda and Schmidt, they're asked to go to the police station for questioning. I can't even begin to imagine how horrific that would be for Amanda. I genuinely can't. I mean, she has just literally tried to save the life of her sister, who is beloved to her, and now she has to go to the police station to answer questions. I understand that that's really important for evidence. I know that it's important to get the story straight quite quickly because people's brains go into trauma mode and often you can forget things. But it must have been truly harrowing for her to have actually had to do that just after discovering her sister in such a horrendous state. Now, when Schmidt is brought in, what can we say? The story that he starts to tell initially, well, it begins to change. He actually is interviewed initially for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. And during that period of time, he is just changing his story constantly. And of course, that's a massive red flag for investigators. It's as simple as that. When there were loads of inconsistencies that early on, it really does start to point the finger of suspicion at you. Then, after around 2 hours, when the police are clearly showing him that they're not quite sure where this story is going, when they're pointing out these inconsistencies, when they're holding him back to the story so he has to analyse it and go through it and make sense of it, it all becomes a little bit too much. And then Schmidt finally says, "It was an accident and I didn't mean to shoot Alana." So now they know that there was no guy and actually Schmidt is the responsible party. At this point, the interview is terminated. Schmidt is then read his Miranda rights because bear in mind, he was there as a witness, not as a suspect initially. Now, even though he's given his Miranda rights, he does continue to speak and then he changes his story again. So now we've gone from there's this random guy running through the woods who's killed her to, okay, it was an accident, I did it. And then when he's describing the shooting itself, the story keeps changing again. So they just can't make sense of what he actually did and how it played out. All they know is that he is the responsible party when it comes down to Alana's death. So at this point, he is, of course, arrested and charged for her murder. And the actual police said that when they looked at Alana Callahan's injuries, it was clear that she was shot from behind as she sat at the computer. She was just on Facebook in the dining room of the home. So she fortunately would not know what had happened to her. And I take some comfort from the fact that that beautiful girl, that amazing young woman to be, she would not have gone through the horror and fear as she would have if she had known what was coming. Basically, the bullet entered the back of her head and it exited out of the front of her mouth. So she was executed full stop. She was shot with a 9mm handgun and that handgun actually belonged to her father. After she'd been shot and killed, she was then dragged outside across the backyard. She was dragged into the woods. It's around 200 feet away from where she was shot. And we've got to remember, this is a 14-year-old boy who's doing this. Now, bear in mind, the gun box and the gun manual of the 9mm handgun, which was used to shoot her, that's found in Schmidt's home. It's actually found in his bathroom. Also, they found multiple items that actually belonged to the Callahans. So he had quite a few items of the Callahans in his home, included a camera, it included jewellery. Also, they were able to find the gun located hidden in the woods. So he tried to dispose of the weapon. So there's no way he's going to get away with the fact that he hadn't planned this to some degree. He'd stolen a gun from Alana's own father and he'd actually used that weapon to kill her. Now, at this point, he's held at the Regional Youth Detention Centre and obviously they have to do an autopsy on this gorgeous girl because they need to know exactly what played out. So the autopsy was performed and Columbia County Coroner Verna Collins, he confirmed that Alana had died indeed of that gunshot wound to the head and also it had injured the neck as well. Now, this trial, for those of you who are interested, it was actually recorded, so you can go and watch it on court TV. I think there is just really a human interest whenever it is a young person who's carried out a killing, because it feels so distinct from what we expect. And obviously, there is a huge amount of information that you can garner from watching that trial. Now, when that begins, the opening statement to the court by the prosecution, it was basically that Alana Callahan's death was a cold-blooded murder. And I think we can all agree, it absolutely fits that category. So the prosecutor said that Schmidt was absolutely obsessed with the Callahan family. She said that Schmidt stole Alana Callahan's father's gun for one purpose, which was to kill Alana. And again, you can't definitively say that. It could just be that he wanted to steal a gun. Like, kids are interested in guns. And also, in a place where guns are legal, you can appreciate that some kids want to get to that point where they can have one. And when you get an opportunity to steal one, if you've got a particular mindset, that might be something that interests you, and you might not want to do anything with that as far as crime is concerned. But I think we can buy into this belief that Schmidt was so rageful, so angry, so unhappy about the fact that he was banned from going to the house for a few weeks, and also so upset that, as far as he was concerned, Alana had rejected him, that there was this festering within him, and that's why he'd actually premeditated the kill. Because at the end of the day, we just have to think about the fact he'd waited for Alana to be completely alone, and that's when he'd carried out the murder. That's when he'd used her own father's gun to murder her. Also, the prosecutor said what had happened is that Schmidt had stood behind Alana, shot her, killing her almost instantly before dragging her body out to the woods. And then the prosecutor went on to say, listen, this was premeditated. But the other thing we have to remember is this kid had absolutely no desire to get caught for it initially. He made up this really elaborate story about this guy that he sees running through the woods. So he's been thinking about this story to cover up the crime. Now, in the defense's opening statement, they basically said, listen, Alana's death was a tragedy, but it was not a cold-blooded murder. They said this is a case about a seriously traumatized, neglected, abused 14-year-old boy who snapped. So they're using his background as a mitigation, and the fact that this is not cold-blooded murder, is not premeditated, this is a moment of madness, essentially. So the defense said that he'd taken the gun out of the Callahan's home a few days before the incident. This is apparently after he had been beaten up. And therefore, they're saying his motivation was basically he'd taken it for protection. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that's a bit of a stretch. Because even if you do get beaten up, and that's awful, the idea that the way you're going to handle it next time is by stealing a gun and killing the perpetrators, because that's essentially the only way you can look at that. Why else would you have a gun? You're obviously going to threaten the people at the very least, but one would argue, well, is that just what you're manifesting in your head when you're imagining what you're going to do if somebody hurts you again? Probably not. And also, most of us wouldn't think of that. We'd think about taking some action to protect ourselves through the authorities or through our caregivers or through our teachers. We wouldn't be thinking to ourselves, right, well, I'll get a gun and I'll deal with it myself, because the consequences of that are going to be enormous for you. Now, the defense said, listen, find Schmidt not guilty of malice murder, but find him guilty of the lesser offence of voluntary manslaughter. So they're not saying that he didn't kill her. They're saying they just didn't believe that he had killed in a malicious way. Now, both of Alana's parents, they actually testified during this case, and they said, listen, he was a friend of the family. He was welcomed into our home. He was somebody that we felt, to some degree at least, that we could trust, and he's betrayed us in the most horrendous of ways. Also, workers of school buses in the area testified, and one of those recalled seeing Schmidt on the 31st of January walking with his hood up, so clearly trying to disguise himself. So there, again, suggesting there is a level of premeditation there, because why is he disguising himself in that way? Why is he trying to lie low in that moment? Now, Deputy Russell Lloyd, that's somebody who worked for the Columbia County Sheriff's Office, they testified, and he was the person who actually responded to the call on the 31st of January 2011. And he said that in his memory, which was very traumatic, he saw Amanda chase Anne Schmidt at the scene. And he said that Amanda was just understandably screaming, she was hollering, she was saying that her sister's bleeding really bad, because bear in mind, Amanda hadn't figured out that her sister had been shot. He said that he then goes and approaches the body checks for a pulse, couldn't find the pulse, and then obviously tries to administer CPR, but it's unsuccessful. And he said that whilst the Mandarin Chase was just contextually being really emotional, crying, desperately upset, Schmidt wasn't. In fact, he said he just didn't seem to care. He said that if he had to describe it, Schmidt showed absolutely no emotion. And bear in mind, this is meant to be a really close friend. Alana was meant to be really important to Schmidt. Alana was meant to be the person that he wanted to be with. And yet she's lay dead after he shot her. And there is just this kind of disassociation from the reality of what we expect. Now, Alana's sister, Amanda Callahan, she testified because obviously she was the first on the scene, essentially. And she said it was just heartbreaking because they treated Schmidt as a family member. He'd come round to the house 6 or 7 days a week. She also said that his relationship with Alana, as far as she could see from the outside looking in, was like a brother and sister. So a trusting one, a protective one. She also said that on the 31st of January 2011, she'd first seen Schmidt when she'd been picking up Alana from the bus stop. He'd come to tell her he wasn't allowed to come round to the house for the next 2 weeks, as we know. She said that after she dropped off Alana and gone back for Chase and then arrived back at the house, one of the first things that she noticed was Schmidt's shoes at the house. And she said it was just one of those things because it was out of place. And then she noticed other things out of place. So the chair was knocked over, there was stuff all over the carpet. Obviously, very sadly, that stuff was later determined to be Alana's blood. Now, as Amanda is leaving through the back door, obviously concerned about where her sister is, Schmidt had come in through that front door. He said, "Oh my God, someone took Alana and I don't know what to do." So again, very much suggesting there'd been some kind of abduction. He then talks about this man who's running through the woods. Understandably for Amanda, this is horrifying. So they go in the backyard. Schmidt said he'd seen Alana's body and then pointed Amanda in the direction. So like I said, very convenient how this is playing out. He's not just discovered that this man has come and taken Alana, he's now discovered her dead body. Now, apparently he was stood quite far from Alana's body. And Amanda said, the truth is, where he was stood, there was absolutely no way he would have actually been able to see her body at all. So he must have known where it was. She said at that point, she calls 911 and then she conducts CPR on Alana. And she said that the reason that she put Schmidt on the phone was because she was just getting really frustrated at the time with dispatch. She was trying to listen, she was trying to revive Alana at the same time. She's obviously beside herself emotionally and she just needed somebody to take over. She then said that when the officers arrived, they actually were moved to the front yard. They wanted to get them away from the scene. And she first believed that the officers were actually accusing her of killing her sister. And she said at that point, she was thinking, well, I didn't do it. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no way that Schmidt did it. So she obviously felt that they were pointing the finger at her, but also undeniably felt there was no way that any of them were involved. Now, Amanda had also testified that Alana had previously told her and her mother that she'd lost her keys. So she didn't even have them when she died. And those keys were actually found on the driver's side floor of her dad's truck. This is a couple of weeks after Alana's death. Now, Schmidt, he absolutely had access to that truck whilst Amanda was calling 911, as she told him basically to turn the truck off. So the belief is he went and placed those keys that he'd used previously to get into the home there to try to displace any people being suspicious of him getting into the house because he'd had access to those keys. He wanted it to seem that he'd never had any access and that's why he'd placed them there. Now, understandably, they also in court brought the 911 dispatcher. So she actually was the person who'd taken that call on that fateful day. The recording of the 911 call was actually played to the court. And it is just so clear that Amanda is absolutely heartbroken. She's distressed. She's saying that she's found her sister in the woods. She says that she hasn't got any idea what happened to her, but that she's covered in blood. And as we would expect, she's been directed on how to do CPR. And then, as we know, Aaron Schmidt's put on the phone. Now he, bear in mind, you're meant to be in shock, you're meant to be traumatised, you've got no idea what's happened, you are completely oblivious to the crime that's played out because you're not involved, and yet he's not only told her sister where she is body-wise, or at least apparently in an injured state at that point. He also now is telling the dispatcher that there's a bullet hole mark in her head. Now, think about the state of this. Think about the blood. Think about the hair. Think about the chaos. Are you really going to be that cool, calm and collected in this moment in time that you are going to be able to say, oh, I think that this is a bullet hole? That's another indicator of guilt, without a doubt. He also, as I've said, talks to her about the fact that someone was running through the woods dressed in black. And he also said to that dispatcher that he went to see if he could find them because he apparently knew that nobody was meant to be down there. So this is very strange. Now, with respect, the dispatcher did say that he sounded quite distraught and that he didn't actually sound calm, which is kind of a different story than the officer who turned up at the scene felt. He felt that he was kind of cool, calm and collected for this situation. So was it that in that moment he was starting to become anxious about what he'd done, or was it just that he was play acting? Was he just doing some method acting in that moment where he felt that that was how you should sound in this circumstance? Now, Sergeant James Summers, he also testified, he worked for a crime scene investigation, and the camera footage was shown of the area around the crime scene. This is including the actual house itself. He had to go through many, many crime scene photos that were taken and just evidence exactly how the crime had played out. So the jury was shown so much information to try to help them piece together what played out that day. Also, Sergeant Tim Burnley also testified. He's another crime scene investigator. Again, he went through all the crime scene images. So basically, he went through images from the scene that showed how Alana was dragged across the yard, which is just devastating, isn't it? And again, it's incredibly incriminating for Schmidt. Deputy Scott Zimmerman, he testified he worked for the K-9 unit of Columbia County. And he said when he actually turned up, he initially arrived thinking it was going to be a home invasion where someone had been shot and where the perpetrators had fled. So initially, he's basically spending a lot of time searching the surrounding area for articles that might have been disregarded or for any kind of information that the dog can kind of locate. And in the end, his dog locates a gun. That gun had been buried under leaves. And we all know that gun was, of course, Alana's father's that Schmidt had taken. Then Detective Argent Miller testified. Now, he works for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation at the State Crime Lab. And he's actually a firearms examiner. So he determined that the cartridge cases and also the bullet that was found at the crime scene, they were both fired from the firearm that was found in the surrounding area of the home. So again, that's another incriminating factor. Then the prosecution brought in Thomas Pittman. He was a 15-year-old resident of Harlem. He was also a cousin of Schmidt. And he basically said that prior to January the 31st, 2011, he was actually best friends with Schmidt. He saw him on a daily basis, and he said, I actually knew the Callahans because of Schmidt. That was the introduction that led to me knowing him. And he described the relationship of Schmidt with the Callahans as being incredibly close. He actually said that he'd seen Schmidt the day before Alana's death, and he said one of the things about him was he was in a really good mood. You know, he didn't seem to be ruminating, he didn't seem to be angry. And they actually played Pittman's police interview in court. And again, that just shows you the unstable nature with respect of Schmidt, that he can be really happy and chatty one day and then carry out a cold-blooded execution the next. They also brought in Diana Chitty, who's Schmidt's sister and legal guardian. And she said on the 31st of January 2011, she had actually recalled a call from Amanda Callahan. And she said that Schmidt was basically helping her to find Alana. She said that on that specific day, he wasn't actually allowed to leave her house. He was on restriction, but that she knew the Callahan family through Schmidt. And she said that because of that, she would go around on a regular basis. She said that she gave police permission to question Schmidt, but that she didn't say that he could be interrogated. She also said that she was actually unaware that he was treated as a suspect. And again, they played her interview in court. So what she did basically was indicate in her interview that someone else in the area may have been responsible. So there was this boy who'd apparently stolen Schmidt's money the week before Alana's death. And she also said that there had been instances of molestation when Schmidt was young, but that he had never hurt animals or kids. She also said that at no point did she think that her brother was actually responsible for this murder. So she just didn't believe he had it in him whatsoever. Now, in her questioning by the defence, she went on to say that when he was younger, she had actually gone ahead and had him evaluated because he started sitting in a corner and he was wailing and he was rocking. He actually sat under a chair in a fetal position. So understandably, that's showing a very traumatised child. The prosecution then went really hard line on her with respect and asked if she'd ever called the police when she learnt that her father had fathered a child to his stepdaughter. She said actually she hadn't called the police at that point and neither had anybody else. But understandably, it's a very challenging scenario that plays out in that moment in court, isn't it? Because with respect, she's considerably older than Schmidt's biological mother, and it is a failure to protect if you find out that a 13-year-old child has been molested by an adult who is your biological father and has had a baby. Surely there is absolutely a need to contact child services. But she said she didn't call the police or social services. Basically, at the end of the day, she didn't do that. And there was also an occasion when he was actually left in the car alone as a child. And again, that didn't get a call to child services either. So there's been a massive failure to protect Schmidt without a doubt. But is that enough for us to believe that this trajectory of becoming a killer was because of those kind of instances? Absolutely not. Now, another investigator who quickly arrived at the scene was James Edmonds. He testified and he was curious about the way that Schmidt was acting at the crime scene. So obviously we've had one first responder saying that he really was quite kind of cold and disconnected. We've had the actual person who took the call saying, oh no, he was distraught. But this particular individual said, you know, actually what I saw was Aaron Schmidt at the bottom of the stairs in front of the home. And the only time he would start to cry is when he thought somebody was looking at him. If he saw somebody looking at him, connecting with him, he'd cry again. And then he'd stop when he thought that the coast was clear, essentially. And that investigator said that when he arrived, he could immediately see drag marks at the back of the house on the stairs leading to where her body was. He also said there was blood in the drag marks. There was a sock at the bottom of the stairs and there was also blood on the back porch. Bear in mind, at this point, the investigators had been told by Schmidt there was a guy running around dressed in black. So that's what they were looking for. He also recalled Amanda and Aaron Schmidt being taken to be interviewed. And he was the one who first interviewed Amanda Callahan. So at this point, of course, he's just trying to draw out as much information about what had played out in that situation that she could recall. He said some of the things that were being said just didn't really add up. So he ended up asking some really challenging questions just to try and clarify what had happened. He said that Amanda was very upset during the interview and that she did genuinely try to relay all the information that she had, but it was chaotic to some degree because it's a chaotic experience. Now, by the information not adding up, he said that he meant that she was saying things that were told to her by Aaron. So Amanda never changed her account. There was no suspicion really, aside from the one that she thought they might have on her, but there wasn't really any directed at her. But it was the account she was telling. So he said there was nothing in the interview that suggested Amanda believed Schmidt was responsible for the death of her sister. He then spoke with Diana Chitty, who Schmidt's his sister and legal guardian, and he spoke to her to find out what she knew and also to let her know that Aaron was there and needed to speak with him. As she recalled in court, she said she was open to that. She said, do whatever you have to do. Although obviously she says that she didn't think he was a suspect at that point. He then interviews Aaron Schmidt. And at this point, he was interviewed as a witness. Now the following day, he goes to the residence of Diana Chitty. And he basically goes there to get consent to search the room of Aaron Schmidt and also the residence. She did provide consent. During that search, he finds the gun box. He finds missing ammunition from the Callahan home. And by this point, Paul Callahan had informed the police that they were indeed missing. And there were also images that are shown to the court from the residence. So in the bathroom, this is off Schmidt's bedroom, the gun box was found in a cabinet. The missing ammunition was also found in that cupboard. And then obviously they also find other items. So in his bedroom, in a dresser drawer, was a gun's owner's manual. So they collect all of these from the search. It came for the jury. This is really incriminating information. And that detective returns to the home on the 7th of February. Now, during this search, he turns up even more stuff from the Callahans. So he finds a camera, he finds an MP3 player, he finds an iPod. This is all belonging to the Callahan family. And they were all found in Ari Schmidt's bedroom in a book bag in his closet. Now, during an interview with Ari Schmidt, he was basically asked to remove his shoes, and they found straight away there was loads of blood on the top of his socks. He also said that during an interview with Schmidt, there were more than five different stories that he told the police. So again, really incriminating information here. Now, investigator Brian Jones for the Columbia County Sheriff's Department testified. He's a criminal investigator. He said upon his initial approach to the residence, one of the things that he noted was that there was just several people essentially from the sheriff's office who had arrived before him. Also, he noted there was a crime scene tape there. So clearly they were setting up the fact that there was a crime that had played out. Again, he testified that Amanda Callahan and Aaron Schmidt were basically around the front porch area when he first arrived. And at this point, he said he'd formulated a plan with the other investigator. He got an overview of the scene, and at this point they had decided to bring Amanda Callahan and Aaron Schmidt to the Criminal Investigation Division offices to interview them. Even though it was very traumatic, it was something that was required. And as we noted, Amanda was the first person to be interviewed, which really started to destabilise Aaron Schmidt's story. And of course, when she was first interviewed, as we noted, they'd not determined whether she was a suspect at that point. She was just a witness, but always they have this conscious understanding it could change from witness to suspect. He, of course, then gets interviewed, and whilst he's not under arrest immediately because of the changes in the stories, and then finally because he says, look, it was an accident, I didn't mean to do it, they then have their guy. Now, bear in mind, in the court, they are trying to show that Schmidt's a liar and also an individual who's trying to get away with murder. That's really important when you bear in mind that they want him for first degree murder. So this particular investigator is saying that Aaron basically said that he walked through the woods. He basically came across the Callahan's property. He sees a guy who looks at him, and then this guy starts running. He described the man as a tallish person wearing greyish blackish pants, black boots, black jacket and a black beanie. He said he's pretty sure the guy was white. He also said he found it odd, so he went to check the Callahan house thinking that somebody might have broken in. He said at the point that he went into the Callahan house, he realised that the chair had been tipped over, and he said that he thought he'd seen Kool-Aid on the floor, which is obviously the blood. He also said that he walked out of the back door and then he sees these drag marks. So apparently this guy is very intuitive of all of this stuff that's going on in this chaotic situation. He also then recounted how Amanda came back and they actually found Alana's body. Now, like I said, it changed several times. So the next account is that he says that he sees this guy running through the woods. At this point, he decides to be the hero. He tries to follow him through the woods. And then he sees this guy on the back porch of the Callahan home, and then he sees him run off from the porch, and this is when he apparently goes into the house, tries looking for Alana, and then he meets Amanda. Now, the only thing that you can say is he does maintain the story of the man in the woods for a while, but then the description of the man, it changes several times. But I suppose we can say he maintained that this guy ran through the woods. Then his story starts to change again, which obviously makes him deeply suspicious. And then at this point he says he did know who the man in the woods was. In fact, it was a neighbour. And then he said it was a guy called David Mathis. You can imagine David Mathis is like, sorry? So what do you mean it's David Mathis? What do you mean it's me? I had nothing to do with this. Why is my name getting brought into it? But this is the kind of thing that often happens, isn't it? Now, of course, Schmidt becomes the centre party to this crime when, during the interview, he admits that he had the gun in his hand and he says that it was a tragic accident. But this is after going through all of those different story changes. And when he was actually talking about that, apparently the detective said his demeanour was calm and that he did get upset a couple of times, but nothing massively when you consider what we're talking about. And One of the things that he failed to explain during that interview was how he came in possession of the ammunition, the gun box, or the gun manual, or in fact, any of those items that had been found in his room that had been missing from the Callahan residence. So he's telling a set of circumstances and stories, but he's not actually identifying why all of this material, including the smoking gun essentially, was found within his possession. Now, they played that interview in court, and of course, the jury is sitting there going, I don't know about you, but do we actually need to go any further than the fact he's changed his story 35 times is kind of enough? And also, that poor guy that he's now incriminated. So he really wants to get away with this. The officers apparently told him that one of the things that was clear from the get-go was there was no man running through the woods. So of course, at this point, he admitted that he was there at the time Alana was shot. But then he says it was another man who killed her. Then the officers are like, I'm just going to throw it out there, Aaron, your story is making absolutely no sense whatsoever. So they're just not having it at all. Then he said, look, I know who's responsible. And then he tries to pin it on somebody else. And then he tries to tell the officers that what actually happened was that him and Alana were just playing around, they were goofing around, and then Alana got accidentally shot. Now, again, that makes no sense. And if that were the case, if this was a terrible, tragic accident, you know, and these things do happen very rarely, but they do happen, you would be telling them that right at the beginning. You would be telling the emergency services exactly what had happened at the very beginning. You wouldn't be trying to create this elaborate ruse to displace any guilt that you have and project it onto someone else. It just doesn't make sense. And the investigators know it. And to some degree, Schmidt starts to realise it as well. When he was read his Miranda rights, apparently he just maintained it was an accident. And one of the things he said, which is going to be massively and quite easily disputed in court, is he said, look, I barely tapped the trigger. Now, that's not going to make any sense because anybody who's a ballistics expert is going to be able to dispute this immediately because it just doesn't match the evidence whatsoever. You have to have a level of force on that trigger before you can actually pull it. And that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Because it's challenging when you have a gun in your hand anyway and you're angry. The last thing you want is to then have to just lightly tap something to actually mean that the gun unloads. That's a terrifying reality, and it would cause more deaths if that were the reality that we're talking about. When Daniel Brown, who was for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, he's the regional medical examiner, he was the one who performed Alana's autopsy. When he testified in court, he basically said and validated about how the bullet had passed through Alana's neck and jaw, how it entered from the back to the front. But he also said it didn't immediately kill her, which is really devastating. I imagine it was quick, but it wasn't immediate. But I imagine the shock and chaos and trauma probably meant that she wasn't really feeling what was happening in that moment. At least I hope that was the case. He said the cause of death was determined as that gunshot wound and that the manner of death was indeed homicide, just to validate to the jury that that is exactly what they're dealing with in this case. Now, when it came down to the defense closing argument, and understandably, they had a hard hill to climb because the prosecution had a really strong case. They basically argued that this was a case of this young kid snapping. The evidence showed that he just freaked out. Went on again to reiterate, this was a traumatized, abused, neglected young boy in tragic accident that killed a girl he loved from a family he loved. So she's trying to say it's nonsensical that he killed her. Obviously it was an accident. So she basically is a defense is saying, listen, because he loved them so much, because he didn't want them to feel rejected like he'd been rejected, he needed to let them know that because of him breaching boundaries with the Callahans, because they'd kind of been in agreement with his half-sister, that it was inappropriate that he was going round, he was on this time out for 2 weeks, he wanted to let them know about the restriction. And then the defense said he was just walking home, decided to hang out in the woods. Then he thinks to himself, I'm going to let Alana know that I'm on this restriction. The defense then painted this picture of him walking to the house, telling Alana, but then he takes his shoes off. He goes up to Alana, bear in mind he's already stolen the father's gun. And the defense went on to say, listen, we don't actually know what went on in the living room, but what we do know is that when the gun went off, Schmidt freaked out. And then she played into the, he was a 14-year-old kid. I mean, I think you're stretching it there, Ms. Defence. I think you're stretching it there. I think we all know exactly what happened because the evidence is clear. But now they're going to paint this picture that this is just a freaked out child who didn't mean to shoot his friend in the back of the head. The defence then said he basically realised he killed the daughter of a family he loved, and all he could think about was he needed to blame someone else. This defence lawyer also stressed that the bus driver and his cousin said on the day that he killed her that he was normal, he wasn't brooding, he didn't apparently seem like he was plotting anything, he was just apparently being normal. Well, again, that just doesn't have any leverage in these kind of cases because that can just mean he's a cold-blooded killer. Serial killers don't walk around in the shadows. They don't hang out with the kill kit in corners. That's not how it works. They're perfectly logical, sequential, and normal to the families. And then they go and brutalise and kill somebody in the most horrendous ways. That's how killers are. They don't have the same level of conscience as you or I. So they can seem chirpy and happy and normal. And then they can go and murder somebody. That's how it works. That actually does the opposite of defending his nature. It actually is an aggravating factor as far as I'm concerned. Now, this defence lawyer said in the hours and the hours of police interrogation, he basically tried to make his story fit the facts. Yes, he did, because he was guilty. Now, during the interview, he said that he didn't want the Callaghans to be mad at him, so she said this was his fear. She also went on to say, listen, the prosecution's evidence is just trying to paint him as a cold-blooded killer, but actually, he is a traumatised kid. She said it was an accident, and why it's awful to acknowledge, you also have to accept that this is reality. She even said, why would he have taken off his shoes going into the house? Well, that's because it's a habit, with respect. You know, we go through some automatic responses in these situations. If you usually take your shoes off when you go into a house, even if you're going to go and kill the person in that house, you're probably going to take your shoes off because you've just got into a habitual response to doing those things. So basically, this is what is trying to be painted. And she also, as a defence lawyer, says that he knew that Amanda was going to be home quickly, so therefore why would he have done it if it wasn't an accident? Well, because he had time. It took minutes. It's as simple as that. But this is the picture that she's trying to paint. He's a victim. He's not really a perpetrator. It was a terrible mistake. It wasn't actually based in malice. This was not a premeditation or malice reality. This was actually a scenario where he had made a mistake, and she asked the jury to find him not guilty based on that accident, which of course doesn't really make a lot of sense for the jury, with respect. And the prosecution are strong. In those closing statements, basically the lawyer said that after school on the 31st of January, Alana Callaghan had gone home from school, gone on the computer, gone on Facebook, and she said Schmidt was waiting in the woods. He was waiting for his opportunity. She said, just consider the timing. Paul Callaghan, firstly, was out of town at the time of the murder. He'd left 8 days prior. A few days later, Schmidt's in the home of the Callaghans. Bear in mind, he's in that home without permission. This is what sparked the time out. Alana then comes home. She hears a noise that scares her. That turns out to be Schmidt. We know then that Betty Jo Callaghan had freaked out. She was angry with Schmidt. He left. And the prosecution said it was in this incident that Schmidt became angry at Alana. As far as he was concerned, the relationship that he'd had with her had interfered with the relationship with the Callaghan family. So she's now the problem in this situation. He then thinks he's going to lose the wider relationship with the Callaghans. Apparently, there were only 2 days a week where Betty Jo didn't pick up Alana from the bus stop. And this is when Amanda picks her up. She went on to say, Schmidt got home at 2:05 p.m. For an hour and a half in the rain, he was walking around with a gun in his pocket. She also said, listen, the gun that was used would never have accidentally gone off. It takes pressure. They had a ballistics expert come in and say it took a lot of pressure. So she says that Schmidt walked into the home with a gun that was loaded, a chamber ready to go off. He walked up to Alana Callaghan and he shot her in the back of the head. She then obviously falls over. He at that point panics. He drags her body all the way down to the woods. A 120-pound body, 200 feet. Then he runs, he hides the gun deep in the woods. He then hears the truck, runs around the front of the house, and then he begins to fabricate this false story. She also asked, why would he wait for the 3 minutes in a day where he could be alone with Alana to go around? She said that in itself shows you it was cold-blooded, premeditated murder. She said this was not an accident. And she said the only reason that he said it was an accident is because the police interrogation clearly evidenced that he was lying. So he was confronted with all these facts, and that's when he changes his story. And she said that he spoke of Alana with callousness. He described what he did with her body. He never explained how the gun box manual or ammo was in his house. He never explained why he decided to take the loaded gun back to the Callahan's house that day. All the important factors and facts he just didn't go into. She also said, listen, the truth is Schmidt was jealous of Alana. He wanted the family that she had, and she threatened that which was... He wanted the family that she had, and that's why he decided to kill her. So she at this point says to the jury, you've got to find him guilty. Now, it took the jury over 4 hours of deliberation, and they did reach a unanimous verdict. So Aaron Schmidt was found guilty of malice murder, felony murder, possession of a firearm in the commission of a crime, and theft by taking. And as that very damning verdict was given, Schmidt showed absolutely no emotion whatsoever. A little bit like on the day that he murdered this girl. Now, during the sentencing, the prosecution asked for life without parole. She said, based on the evidence, Schmidt has literally no chance of being rehabilitated. Also, bear in mind, because this wasn't Schmidt's first victim, that was a very aggravating offence as well. And the defence said that for the past juvenile crime, there was no action done for rehabilitation. So she said, you can't use that fairly. Nobody tried to intervene to rehabilitate him during that experience. So she asks for not a sentence of life without parole, but a sentence of life. So one where obviously there could be a parole opportunity. Now, a statement was given by Schmidt's sister, Elizabeth, and she basically apologised to the Callahan family. She said that Schmidt genuinely did love the Callahans as if they were his own family. She also said that one of the big problems that she believed was going on in his life was that he genuinely never had a father figure. He didn't have somebody who was there for him. His mother wasn't there for him. She also said that the time living with the half-sister, during that period of time, he would be chastised and things were really negative for them then. She would also physically and emotionally punish them. In particular, with Aaron, the half-sister would really be aggressive towards him. And she would actually say it was like she was constantly taking anger out on him. And the family had actually gone through anger management and things did improve at that point. Also, Schmidt's pastor, they also came in and gave a statement, and he said that there is redemption in Schmidt. So he actually asked the judge for mercy. I'm just going to throw it out there. You haven't got a clue. No disrespect. A pastor is not somebody who should be brought into court to depict whether somebody of this actual magnitude, when it comes down to a crime, is redemptive. You don't know that. It sounds like really nice, and I appreciate the big GOD wants to forgive us as long as we actually acknowledge our sins. But you can't say that. The reality is parole boards get it wrong all the time. And I don't think it's helpful to come in and say, oh, you know what, at the end of the day, I'm a pastor and I'm saying he can be saved. Now, his aunt also gave a statement and she rightfully apologised to the Callahans. She also did reiterate what everybody was reiterating, which is that Schmidt had a really difficult life. Again, she asked for mercy. She said he's a child, so please give him mercy because of that. There was also a parishioner in his church who gave a statement. She said that she'd got to know Aaron in church and he'd actually changed. She again reiterated he was redeemable and she asked for mercy. So the defence basically highlighted with these particular individuals giving testimony about his character that he was more a prime candidate for a life sentence and that if they allowed him this chance, one day he could live out his full potential. So this idea that it's really inappropriate to lock him away with absolutely no chance of parole. The prosecution, they disagreed. They said, listen, there's been no apology from Aaron Schmidt himself. He killed Alana. He's never said sorry. And of course, Alana's family came in to speak. So her godmother came in and she actually read a statement from one of Alana's friends. And she said that Alana was a better best friend than anyone deserved. She said that Alana would never judge. She accepted simply everybody with absolute love. She actually said Schmidt betrayed a family who treated him like he really belonged. And she actually said the effect that this tragedy has had on the family has just been enormous. And she said, where was the mercy for Alana? We're talking about the mercy for the actual perpetrator. Where was her mercy? And she actually hoped for him to get help, but she never wanted him to get out of prison for what he did. Also, Alana's sister spoke, and she said Alana's death had massively affected the family emotionally, physically, and mentally. They also spoke of the dreams that Alana had of going to college, becoming a lawyer. And Amanda, who obviously went through the trauma of finding her sister, said that she believes it should be a life for a life. She said Schmidt should not leave prison. In fact, she said, the only thing we have left to hold on to are the memories. To me, Aaron getting life is just not enough. He took my sister. Then he watched me trying to save her with no emotion on his face. Alana's mother, Betty Callahan, she spoke, and she read statements from her in-laws. They said Alana impacted the lives of everyone she came into contact with, and that her family are just affected in every single way, physically, emotionally, financially, mentally. Amanda and her Chase, her siblings, have all been diagnosed with PTSD. They carry the images of their lovely sister's body. They also fear that he was free, he'd do it again. So again, they requested a life sentence without the possibility of parole. And with respect, I completely concur. How would we ever know that this individual was actually ever going to be safe? We know that he's stolen the dreams of a 14-year-old girl and destroyed a family in its wake. The very fact is that to take a chance on his freedom is to take a chance on another potential victim. So all of the family members basically said, we want life without parole. Also, it's worth noting that the family said they didn't hate Aaron. They hated what he did, and they also hoped that one day he'll tell the truth of why. So none of them want him out of prison, but they also don't want to harbour that resentment and bitterness that can destroy them. In fact, in a really moving statement, one of the things that Betty Jo, the mother in this case, said was that she doesn't even want to exist because it's so painful, but she has to for her children. Alana's father, Paul Callahan, he also spoke. He said it's hard for him to live with what happened. He said he treated Aaron no differently, just treated him like he was a family member. Again, he asked for life without parole. And he said that he didn't want those younger children affected by the fear that this boy who will become a man would one day get a second chance to harm their family. He said at the end of the day, he'd already been given a second chance to be part of their family, and now he'd gone out of his way to destroy it. And that's true. In fact, his father said he had a second chance at our house. It's hard to live with knowing that somebody we took in did this. And it's true. It's horrific to imagine that the very people who'd welcomed him into the home were paid back this way. And the prosecution, like I said, they were not having it. They did not want him to have a second chance at life. They felt that it was inappropriate for the family's mental health, and also because of the gravity and nature of the crime, that the idea of him ever being given freedom was too much to bear. Now, the judge acknowledged that Aaron Schmidt had never had a chance to reach his full potential. And because of, well, he's a juvenile, he also acknowledged his brain isn't fully developed, so he doesn't fully realise the consequences of his actions. So we understand that a developing brain doesn't stop developing until 25, so he's 10 years off that. He also admitted that we've got to acknowledge Schmidt's horrible life. But he said, the problem is there was no motive proven in this case. And because of that, I need to consider what I need to do to protect society. He said, when it comes down to it, Schmidt absolutely timed the murder to almost perfection. He shot her in the back of the head. He immediately began dragging her out of the house. He said, listen, this was a cold-blooded, calculated, premeditated murder of an innocent, helpless child who loved him. He said he was emotionless, remorseless during his interviews, through the entire course of the trial, in fact. He said that he feared that if Schmidt was released, he may do it again. Because of that, Schmidt was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 5 years. Some of you may disagree with that because he is a child and his brain hasn't fully developed. But I think for me, the cold-blooded execution is clear, the premeditation is clear, and the trying to cover up is clear. He's not a safe person. Now, Schmidt has appealed his conviction. He said that the judge and his lawyer had made legal mistakes and that his sentence amounted to cruel and unusual punishment with respect. All that you did to that poor girl was cruel, and she didn't even deserve any kind of unusual punishment, and yet you inflicted it on her anyway. Now, in 2015, the court did actually reject his arguments, and his conviction has been upheld by the Georgia Supreme Court. So it seems that Aaron Schmidt will remain in prison for the rest of his natural life. And like I said, it can feel quite overwhelming to imagine a 14-year-old spending forever in prison. Of course it can. It's lifetime after lifetime after lifetime they'll go through. We all know our own transitions and changes. We all know we are not who we were at 14 when we are at 44. But the reality is, when you think about what matters more, his freedom and his potential to go on to be a good pro-social human being versus the mistake of letting him out and him going on to reoffend. Because that's what we're talking about in this circumstance. We're talking about a potential that's within him. And maybe that potential would never be realised, but can we ever take a chance with somebody so deviant in their behaviour, so destructive in their actions? And I think we have to come down on the weight of no. We can never, ever validate that he would be safe to walk the streets again. So let's protect the family who've lost, and let's protect society in a wider sense from these kind of potential predators walking our streets. I'd love to know your thoughts, because a lot of you might disagree with me on this one. And I do get it, because I do believe that young people can change. But like I said, in this case, it just feels so brutal, so cold, so calculated. And because of that, I agree. It should be life without parole. And still, he gets a life. He'll get looked after. He'll get fed. He'll be able to be educated. There are a whole heap of things that he can do to find meaning in his world. But that's not what happened for Alana. She never got to be a lawyer. She never got to get married. She never got to have kids. She never got to celebrate all the wins with her family, that loving family who opened their home to strangers and paid the ultimate price. And for that, he still has a better outcome than she did. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.